Hello, I'm Jim Cornell, and this is the WalkingPost.com podcast. WalkingPost.com is the news website dedicated to walking with all the latest on festivals, gear, trails, and more. Did I mention festivals? This podcast is airing on Friday, May the 2nd, and May is Walking Month. Every month should be, really, but it's nice to promote it to those who don't go out so much. It might be, in part, why the Walking Festivals page on WalkingPost.com shows May as the month with the most events. And this is our 10th podcast, and they said it wouldn't last. I did one podcast that ran for about 5 years, so a long way to go to beat that one. And my radio show ran for about 11 years. I'm not sure how. Maybe they couldn't find a cheaper replacement. 2 days ago, it was still April, and I received an email, I kid you not, to book for this year's Christmas lights in Edinburgh. And it's April. But I guess in a way it's a bit like crowdfunding. If people pay now, they can use the money for light bulbs or whatever it is they need to buy. But I still found it a bit amusing. We're back to nice weather here. It was 21 one day this week, which is a little unusual for this part of Scotland in April. It's actually a little bit sad because normally I'd be delighted by warm weather, but all of the forest fires has made me nervous that we'll get more. It was an expensive week as well, with brakes and new tyres for the car and a new handheld video camera. I bought two that didn't work, but this one does. The screen is a bit small, considering I need glasses now, but I'm sure it will be fine. Last week on the podcast, we had a couple of really interesting conversations, both of which made me want to book trips, but I didn't. We chatted about the Guernsey Walking Festival with Sue Welfare, and we also had an interview about a recently published book, Walking Europe's Last Wilderness, with the author and BBC correspondent Nick Thorpe. This week we also have a conversation about another recent book, and this one is about the famous Camino de Santiago across Spain. The book is called Holy Dirt, and it's by Molly Lord. And we also talk about the wonderfully named old railway line, which is the Strawberry Line, which is being transformed into a path and part of a bigger trail. Of course, before we get to the news, I should let you know that you can reach out with news, press releases, guest ideas and comments via walkingpost.com, or you can just email me at jim@walkingpost.com. So now it's time for our brief look at some of the headlines of the news articles we had on WalkingPost.com this past week. I always find it funny that by the time I put the podcast together, I've forgotten what articles we had. OnX and Toyota launched a trail revival project in the US. Glamping companies were the hot topic at the Canton Fair in China, an event that I'd love to go to. And Parks California has launched a $5 million appeal to help fire-affected state parks in the LA region. Hopefully they can reach that goal quickly and make a difference to trails and also the habitats. The Mammoth Mountain School has been launched, and that's in beautiful Kendal in Cumbria. Garmin launched the Instinct 3 Tactical Edition smartwatch, which has all kinds of features, and there have been calls in the US for increased funding for trails. In gear news, Saucony launched its Silo shoes, and there is a new 4-day trail in Australia, New South Wales to be precise. I guess 4 days is the recommended number, although there's nothing to stop you taking 20. Anyway, you can read all of these articles and many more at walkingpost.com. One of the news stories that I did see from another source this week made it to several news websites. I don't know if you saw this one, but I did laugh even though it's a serious subject. A Chinese hiker in Japan went up Mount Fuji outside of the season, which isn't recommended, and he got altitude sickness and had to be rescued. And of course, any rescue is not a cheap undertaking. But that's not half of the story. He then realised that he'd left his gear and his phone on the mountain, so he went back for them. And you guessed it, he had to be rescued again. I think I'd confiscate his boots at the very least. Okay, let's move on to this week's interviews. Both of them are great, and that's not because of me, obviously. It's definitely down to the guests. First up this week is a hike I'd love to do for the name alone, and that's the Strawberry Line. It's an old railway line that runs from Shepton Mallet to Clevedon in North Somerset. To tell us the story is the chair of the Strawberry Line Society, Mick Fletcher. Really, the first and most obvious question for somebody not from that area is, what is the Strawberry Line?
Well, it's a project and it's a path, in a sense. The project is to provide a traffic-free or a largely traffic-free route between Clevedon and Shepton Mallet, or between Shepton Mallet and the sea, as we sometimes say. And it runs along the southern boundary of the Mendip Hills, and then it cuts up through what used to be an area of outstanding natural beauty and is now the national landscape. It cuts up from there and heads out towards the coast.
Was it always called the Strawberry Line, or is that a more recent name?
It's had that name for 30-odd years as a path. And before that, it was the old railway line. Going back into the last century, Cheddar was famous for strawberries. And a lot of the settlements along the route grew strawberries, sent them up to London, made a lot of money out of it. They used to call it red gold. And so the railway line that connected them became the Strawberry Line. When we took it on as a path, as a kind of multi-user path, then we adopted the name, and the name has got quite a lot of currency now. At one end, there's the Strawberry Line Cafe, which is a project separate to us, but they're based at the railhead at Yatton, where we've got a rail connection to the line. So there's a Strawberry Line Cafe and a Strawberry Line cycle hire.
What are the plans for the trail from Shepton Mallet to Clevedon?
Well, this is a project that's been going for almost 50 years, amazingly. It started out, I think, about 48, 49 years ago as the Cheddar Valley Railway Walk Society. So after Beeching closed the railways, a group of people in Winscombe, near the centre of our path, began to agitate for the local council to buy it and to keep it there as a walk. That was their original idea. And they cajoled and encouraged the council in North Somerset to buy large sections of the path. And so, if you go from Yatton pretty well through to Axbridge and Cheddar, you've got a continuous, largely off-road path there. Once you get into Somerset, we divert through the centre of Axbridge, which is nice because you can go to the pub there or, you know, go to one of the local shops. But that was early on. That was done some 20-odd years ago. And across the county border in Somerset, things were much more slow to develop. That they initially did very little. It's only really in the last 3 or 4 years we've managed to get a really have priority focus on an active travel route. And we've started basically filling in the missing links. So there's a nice section just near where I live. It's only less than a couple of miles long, but it connects two villages with an off-road route that really didn't exist before. You have a choice of going down a busy main road with no pavements or not at all. The footpaths connected by going up the hill to the top of the Mendips, and a pretty steep climb up and then a steep climb down. We were pretty well landlocked. And we've done some work recently in Shepton Mallet. We connected communities across that town. And the most recent thing we did was install a bridge. If anybody knows Shepton Mallet, then the football club, the playing fields, the bike track are all on one side of a busy road and most of the town's on the other. And it actually happened to be on the route of the old railway line. The bridge had been taken down many years ago, but we managed to, with volunteer effort and funding from Somerset Council and a bit from the town council, we managed to put it back. One of the highlights of last year was watching this bridge come down on a low loader from Huddersfield and then get craned into position on top of the supports that volunteers had built.
And I suppose it's not just the expense of having something made. There's also safety issues. You've got to make sure that it's safe.
I mean, we had to comply with, you know, all the relevant legislation and to show to the Highways Authority that we knew what we were doing and to sign a lease that makes us responsible for maintaining it. We're fortunate in that the Strawberry Land Society, which is a completely voluntary organisation, has a partnership with an organisation called Greenways and Cycle Routes, which are headed up by a chap called John Grimshaw, who years ago founded Sustrans. He left to set up this other organisation just to focus on building paths. And he's a brilliant engineer. And he's got a good sidekick as well, Caroline Levitt.
How far along are the plans for the completion, and when do you anticipate the whole thing being finished?
Some years ago, well, about 2006, Somerset Council produced a huge plan for doing the whole thing in one bite. It was just completely unworkable, and it would have taken you years of negotiation and litigation to get anywhere. The whole thing fell apart. So what we're doing is we're just doing where we can, filling in another stretch, adding another little bit. We've been putting in steadily now for the past 3 or 4 years, sections of about 1 kilometre at a time, where it makes sense locally. It provides, you know, a commuter route maybe, or provides a route to school, but it's also part of the big design. So the latest bit we're just working on, over Easter, we put in about 180 fencing panels around the edge of the Kings of Wessex School in Cheddar. And the reason for that is that it again, gives a link from one side of the town to the other without having to go through the narrow bridge over the Yeo and traffic-choked High Street. The agreement with the school, who are very supportive of this, is that the first thing that we had to do was get the fence in place so that when we've got the men and machinery on site subsequently, we don't have any safeguarding issues. We don't have pupils wandering under bulldozers or any of that sort of stuff. And we did that entirely volunteer driven. You know, dug about 180 post holes and carried all this 2-metre-high fencing into place and bolted it in. Quite proud of that. We're now negotiating with the local quarries to see if we can get them to supply stone for the base of the path. Because if there's one thing Cheddar's got, it's stone. Famous for cheese, but actually what its biggest export is, apart from tourism, is limestone. You know, limestone's what we build the path out of in the main. Type 1 aggregate, they call it. You know, stone that were packed down to make a base. And then we use what they call 3 mil to dust. Basically, limestone dust with slightly bigger bits in it that you can roll flat, and it... For most purposes, it wears as well as concrete. If there's somewhere that's going to be very wet, or if we know we're going to get a lot of horses on the path, then we have to stump up for tarmac, which is quite an extra cost.
Speaking of cost, how is it being paid for? And is it all volunteer run in terms of the work that you're doing?
The stuff that we have to pay for. We have to pay for contractors to do some heavy earth moving and in places rock moving. And the money's come one way and another through the local authorities, either from their own funds or from money from central government that comes for active travel or for things like, I don't know, town deals or levelling up funds. There's a whole range of different funds we can tap into, all of which, you know, require quite a lot of negotiation and bidding and patience. Believe it or not, funding's not our biggest problem. Our biggest problem is access to land. So there's some places, for instance, where, well, there's one place where there's an industrial estate built on the track. So obviously we can't do anything about that. There are other places where people have kind of incorporated it into their gardens and there's a tricky negotiation to be had. There are other places where it goes across farmland, and most people seem to have exaggerated fears of what will happen if a path comes near them. They worry that if there's a path at the bottom of their garden, then all sorts of villains are going to appear. Once it's there, people settle down and get used to it and say, can we put a gate so we can get onto it? And we say, well, yes, fine, enjoy it.
How are you kind of getting around that? Because obviously you can't wait for 20, 30 years for somebody to either sell their property or change their mind. How are you circumnavigating some of those issues?
Well, in some cases, there's an alternative. You know, you can just go round them. In some cases, you can work out what it is that worries them. I mean, just to give you one example, we had a farmer who didn't want us to go around the middle of his field. He wanted to go around the edge, and that's fine. But he said, if you do it there, that's the only place the cattle get any shade. And, you know, in the hot summer, etc., they're going to suffer. And so we were able to say, well, all right, if you let the path go through, we'll build you a cattle shelter. So he's got a nice big shed now that the cattle can go in when it gets hot, and they do. There was another instance where the farmer had a track accessing fields across the railway line. And we said, well, we'll put you some gates in, you know, the sort of gates that you can close off the track if he wants to move sheep across, or open up and close off the gates to the fields. And he said, no, I don't want that. I don't want that. People always leave gates open. It's not true, but that's what he thought. But the land was such that we could build him a bridge. We took the path as low as we could and built a bridge, actually out of old railway sleepers. It's rather nice. So he happily goes over the top in his Land Rover, and we cycle and walk and ride underneath.
What's the Somerset Circle, and how does the Strawberry Line fit into that?
Somerset Circle is an idea of linking up all different sections of path around Bath and North East Somerset, Bristol, North Somerset. I mean, if you take it from Clevedon, where if we can get across from Clevedon to Nailsea or to Portishead, you can get routes then already built into Bristol on either the Festival Way or down the Avon Gorge. If you're into Bristol, you can join the Bristol and Bath cycle path. From Bath, you can get the two tunnels way that takes you out towards the North Mendip coalfields. You can join the Colliers Way, which gets you out to Midsummer Norton. Then we've got a little link we need to build, we're working on at the moment, but that would connect up to the Strawberry Line in Shepton Mallet. And then you can follow around the Strawberry Line all the way back to Clevedon at the start. It'd be about 76 miles to go round. And I think it'd be a wonderful attraction. I mean, just think, you know, you're going round that track. You've got, starting from, you know, Cheddar, you've got Cheddar Gorge and the caves. You go past Wookie Hole, you've got the City of Wells. Then you're going up towards Bath, World Heritage Site. You go into Bristol with all the attractions of Bristol. You get out towards the coast at Clevedon, Portishead. And you could sell a holiday on the basis of taking a leisurely or not too leisurely route around the path. And so we've started signing it. My ambition is to get somewhere where we can have a back-to-back signpost, you know, in Shepton Mallet that says Shepton Mallet, 76 miles.
With what you have down there, there are a lot of sort of little side spurs, I guess, to that circle, places like Cheddar Gorge, Glastonbury. Yeah. Would it be easy to incorporate those into a long distance path without having to kind of go down it and then double back to where you started?
I mean, we're certainly working on that. My vision is that the Strawberry Line shouldn't be like a snake. It should be more like a centipede, you know, with the legs reaching out. And certainly there are different ways of getting from Wells into Glastonbury. Two or three different routes you could adopt. And similarly, you can get from Yatton, for instance, both to Clevedon and to Weston-super-Mare on the peer-to-peer way. We're working with North Somerset Council, who are putting in a bypass at Banwell. And as part of that, they're going to link into the Strawberry Line at Sanford. And that will give us a link through to Weston-super-Mare. So we can talk about a circular route, which would take in Yatton, Sanford and Weston. Also, wanting to talk to Network Rail or Great Western Rail, probably, about connecting with their stations. Because they're fairly close to that Somerset Circle at Bristol, at Bath, at Frome, Castle Carey, and then going round to Weston Milton and Yatton. There's a prospect of doing a partial trip on the Strawberry Line and then getting back on the train to get to your starting point. There's a lot of conversations to have, conversations about building the path and conversations about promoting it. But one of those conversations has to be with the tourism authorities in both the cities and towns and county. How can we promote this more? Individual entrepreneurs along the line have got the idea that this is something that can help sell their campsite or their holiday park, and we need to find a way of capitalizing on that so that they can help us extend the line, which would have benefits for them as well.
You would think that there would also be, beyond existing businesses, that there would be the potential for other businesses like the glamping kind of craze and restaurants and little cafes along the line. So
nice little example is a farm we go past on a relatively new section of the line. Farmer's daughters have got a little box there selling duck eggs. You can put in your £1.50 and get half a dozen duck eggs, and it's an honesty box, but it seems to be working, and it's it's really nice. It's three little girls doing it.
You have a website where you can actually buy souvenirs of the strawberry line as well, I think.
It's a recent development. You can get tea towels and mugs and water flasks and things. It's just in its infancy, but it seems to be quite a good system. It's quite simple for us to operate, and we make a little bit of money on it, and we promote the brand, and we're wanting to expand that. We're also wanting to get a supply of this merchandise so that we can appear at shows. North Somerset Show, the Mid Somerset Show, Village Fetes. It's always nice if you've got something that you can sell that people can take away with them.
And I guess, as you mentioned earlier, there are lots of potential users for the different paths.
Yeah, there's walkers, there's cyclists, there's horse riders. People occasionally have strong views for and against horse riding, but we've not had particular difficulty on the stretches of path that we've built recently. Increasingly, I'm thinking these paths are important for older people who want to get in the countryside, but you know, can't manage stiles and don't want to go over uneven ground or sink into boggy ground, but they do want to get out and not just get out on the fine days in the few weeks of summer that we have, but all the year round. These stretches of the strawberry line are incredibly well used by local people, just regularly wanting to get out, take exercise, keep fit. And of course, there's a small number, but an important number of people who are accessing the path through wheelchairs. We have to make sure the design accommodates them.
Where do you go from here?
It's always tricky because I find in this game, things take forever and then happen all at once. Completing the link in Cheddar is our immediate task. Getting the stone dust down, getting the surfacing done, getting another bridge in over the Cheddar Yeo will be an exercise for this early autumn. We'll work with our partners at Greenways in Shepton to build a little bit of the Somerset and Dorset Greenway where it links in with the strawberry line. There's a link which takes people up to some spectacular viaducts in Shepton. If it all comes off, and it will in time, Shepton could be a destination for just the fantastic railway architecture that's there. And then there's the Windsor Hill Tunnels. The path goes across this viaduct through the Windsor Hill Tunnels, which were built for the old Somerset and Dorset Railway and then blocked off for years. They were used briefly for testing Concorde engines. There are two parallel tunnels, so one can be kept for bats and another can be open access for people to progress through. And this link that we're going to be building this autumn actually gets people from the town and from more or less the terminus of the strawberry line up onto that greenway and the path up north towards Midsummer Norton.
Well, let's hope all of that does come together and as soon as possible. The more trails, the better. And the Somerset Circle sounds like it would be a fantastic long-distance trail, what with the Cheddar Gorge and Glastonbury and Wells all being around there. Truly lovely area. Definitely it would make it to my to-do list. Maybe not on my to-do list is the Camino de Santiago in Spain. I've done about a third of the Camino del Norte, the coastal version, and the scenery is breathtaking. But the main Camino de Santiago is definitely very challenging, and there are also lots of people on it. It's also been the inspiration for many books, and a new one has been written recently by American author Molly Lord, and her book, Holy Dirt, is a bit different. But again, I'm not going to tell you about that, I'll leave it to Molly herself. Actually, to give it its full title, the book is called Holy Dirt, A Camino Journey, Out of My Mind, Into My Body, Saved by Song. What led you to tackle the Camino?
I first heard of the Camino from a friend of mine, Patrick. He talked about how he walked it and what it meant to him. And I sat there listening, thinking, oh God, there was a time when I would have latched onto this and said, I want to go. But at the time, I had some old injuries that were coming back to haunt me. And I remember when he mentioned it, the first thing I felt was sad that these injuries were back in my life. And second, this retreat, like I can't even think about something like this. So I dismissed it when I heard about it. And it was a year later when I saw what these injuries were doing and they weren't being rehabbed well. And I thought, I need a carrot. And I decided that carrot was to walk the Camino. And so I gave myself 2 years, 1 year to rehab as much as I could these injuries, and then a year to train. And 2 years after that, I was on the Camino, as crazy as it was.
Did you have to do a lot of research on it, or did you just kind of think, I'm going to take it as it comes?
You know, I'd like to say I was real spontaneous and just left the country. But no, I asked a lot of questions. I read a lot. My angst about it was, if one of these injuries reoccurs, I have a back and knee history. And, you know, can I be helicoptered off a cliff, you know, if something happens? And so my fear ran me for a while. The spontaneous part was, there was so much I didn't know. And I have a leaning toward the unknown. I'm such a contradiction. I have a leaning toward the unknown, and that's exciting. I mean, no matter how much I read, I knew my experience would feel novel. And I liked that. And then on the other hand, I wanted to dot every I and cross every T about being prepared. And at that, the Camino laughs. Oh, you think you're going to be prepared, huh? Hold my beer. So that's how I arrived. Well-read, clueless, both ends.
Were you a hiker beforehand? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've hiked for years. I live in Colorado, and it's out my back door. And it's funny, when these injuries came back, I found that if I hiked maybe just 5 miles, when I came home, I was on ice. So the thought of walking 500 miles, I just had to block that out of my mind and just say, I'll go as slowly as I need to. I used to have this battle with my body. I wanted it to keep up with me. I would over-challenge it and re-injure. And it was a pattern that I had, because I used to be very active. I would kayak and hike and mountain bike. And so when these injuries came back, I didn't accept it very well. I knew on the Camino, if I pulled that stunt, I'd be in big trouble. So I had a new game, and it was, my body would call the shots. If I needed to slow down, I would listen and slow down. If I needed to stop, I would stop. This wasn't a race to Santiago. It was an effort to partner with this body for the first time. I didn't realize until I got there how profound that was for me, and that it was not a struggle. It was like a surrender to this union that I wanted to have with my body for the first time in a long time. So that was my motivation. Survive.
Obviously, you decided you were going to do this. Did you have a book in mind at the beginning of that, or did that come afterwards?
No. Survival was the name of the game. No, I am a writer. I'm a screenwriter. In my at night, I will crawl into my cave and write. I've never written a book. I don't know. I didn't know how to write a book. And no, that wasn't on my mind at all. It was the adventure and the care that I would need to take. It's funny, I returned, and a lot of people, knowing that I like to write, said, oh, I bet you're going to write a book. Like, oh, no. I can't even process in my mind what I just experienced. I don't know how I'd ever put it on paper in a book. So it took, like a lot of people, it took the pandemic shutdown, when my seminars all shut down, and I thought, well, I'm going to at least write down my experience, you know, step by step, and never thought I'd publish it. And when I'm in a writing group, and when they started following me from village to village and every kilometer and what it brought, they're like, oh, you have to publish this. So that's when it came to light of, ah, maybe. And then I did.
There have been quite a lot of books on the Camino. Did you check any of those out and think, I've got to be different to that? Or was it just, no, I'm going to do it my way anyway?
I'm going to do it my way anyway. I had read a couple before I went, stopped midstream. One of them and said, oh, I can't read anymore. Some things I just don't want to know. So that was before I left. When I returned, yeah, I read quite a few of them because it takes you back. And somehow I knew mine would be different because my experience was different. The week before I left, I injured a hamstring. I almost didn't go. And it was Patrick, the same friend who had told me about the Camino. He was going to be 3 or 4 days behind me with friends. They knew I wanted to walk alone. I walked the first week with a friend from here. And then the plan was she would go home and I'd finish alone. But this friend knew how much I wanted to do this. He had helped me train to do this. And I called to say, I can't even walk up my steps. How do you want me to walk the Pyrenees? And it was funny. His answer was, I'm sorry, you must have mistaken me for someone who would buy this story. Well, what kind of sympathy is that? And he said, I know one of the reasons you're doing this is to be bigger than these injuries, to listen to your body. I think right now the Camino's testing you. So you could get on that plane in 2 days and let it heal over there and start walking when it does, or you could sit and pout in your kitchen and wish you were there, and in a week when it's healed, you'll think you should be in Spain. So I realized, you're right. So I went. So it emphasized to me, listen to your body, listen to your body. That was foremost on my mind. So when I sat down to write the book, I was very surprised how my body played the leading role in it and what it really meant to partner with it. So I learned some things, of course, along the way, like everyone does. And I started writing them down. I would scribble them in my phone. One time I even wrote this realization I had on my t-shirt, and then I washed it, but I remembered what it was. And so I kept track of them, and in the book they're called Messages of the Camino, and they're quiet, more serious thoughts. At the end of like every third chapter, I would have one of these Camino messages, that the wisdom I had gained. But then there was a fun part of it that I couldn't not do. And that's that as I walked, there were funny things that happened, and I called them tips from the Camino, like simple things, like if you're buying soap to wash your clothes, make sure it's not toilet bowl cleaner, because that's what happened to me. So just tips. And so about every 4 or 5 chapters, there's tips from the Camino, and there's like 7 or 8 listed that makes it fun. So I just took a different approach, and probably the most unique part of my book, and I couldn't not do this, is my work here at home is working with music and how music impacts our mood, our health, and our perspective. That's what my seminars are on. So how could I not have music follow me on the Camino? I didn't listen to music a lot, but I did have certain songs with me, and I knew exactly when to push play on certain songs. I knew what I needed, and I knew what it would do for my psyche. So I had those, and then you run into music on the Camino. You walk in a cafe, you know, on this mountain, isolated mountaintop. I walked in one time, and I heard Cat Stevens' The Wind, which is one of my favorite songs. Like, what are the chances, you know, of hearing this English song? And so I collected songs that showed up like that. And by the time I got home, I had the soundtrack of my Camino. I used to work with Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary. So I had collected all these songs while walking over the 5 weeks. And I'm sitting in a cafe right before I am leaving Santiago. And it's a little French cafe, grabbing some lunch. And I hear this familiar tune. And it's Puff the Magic Dragon in French. And I guess that's the last song in my soundtrack. So what I decided to do in the book was every time a song presented itself along the trail in one way or another, I put it in the book. I listed the song, the artist, and I have a QR code that if the reader wants to know the state of mind I was in at the moment. And the thing is, it wasn't just about my state of mind. I believe what happened in each chapter and the song that I associated it with, people relate to in their own life, whether they're on the Camino or not. The struggles on the Camino are our struggles at home. They're just highlighted. And you can almost hear the Camino say, hold my beer, you know, just because things get so quiet. But yeah, it's just like in life. The Camino is a microcosm of life. You've hiked enough to know.
Do you think that some of the Peter, Paul, and Mary and the Cat Stevens, do you think that some of that is kind of like the universe reaching out to make connections?
What a good question. Coming from where I come from, yes, I trusted that. When I was training and working through these injuries, I would often in the gym have, or walking trails, have my headset in listening to certain music. I pick it carefully because I've learned what it does. And there's a song, Paul Simon's Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes. And that became my anthem to get through tough training days. And it was on my phone going over, and I didn't know when I would be moved to play it. These songs weren't something I put on every morning. I just waited until something happened and that song spoke to me. And it wasn't until my last day walking towards Santiago that I push play. This little boy said, now, and I push play on Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes and thought, oh, it used to be a carrot. And now I'm partnering with it to go this last leg of the trip. So yeah, music has a way of creeping in as a gift from the universe. I really believe that. Music is an entity unto herself. I believe she's a living, breathing being.
Did you stay with other people in the dormitory kind of style, or did you do hotels?
I know. I stayed in two hotels during that time. One with a bathtub. I was in heaven. I did a combination. In Burgos, I stayed in the municipal, the big one, and I call it the night from hell in Burgos. That was a rough one. I stayed in smaller ones where maybe you bunked with maybe 10 to 20 people. That was doable. And sometimes I just said, I need a private room tonight. So it was a variation, and I had no problem sending my pack ahead on days when I felt my knee just would rebel. I didn't get hung up on, oh no, I must carry this. That wasn't my challenge. My challenge was just being there. Be where your feet are. It wasn't, oh, I want to say I carried my pack every moment. But I carried it a lot.
Now, obviously, the whole thing would be a highlight, but what were some of the highlights and maybe even some of the lowlights for you?
Yeah. I had outward happenings and I had inward happenings that were highlights. One very, it might be odd to some, it wasn't to me, but it did catch me by surprise, is I had people who have parted this earth, good friends, my dad, visit me in one obvious way or another. And I just hadn't thought about that, you know, about that happening. But it was very clear who was there, like, who was my drive-by of the moment? And what was, each has their own signature where I know it is they that have appeared. And sure enough, that would happen. That was a huge highlight and like this giddy treat for me whenever it did happen. I think it was the people that were my highlights. I met characters. I met spiritual teachers. I met angels, and not the kind with wings, but those that swoop in the nick of time when you feel like I'm in trouble here. Those moments were highlights. I think if I had to choose. So I have a friend, Michael Johnson, who a longtime friend, and he passed away. Michael was a Nashville musician. You're a musician. You may remember him from the 70s, Bluer Than Blue. And he was a master guitarist. And he passed away 2 years before the Camino. And he was instrumental, not in suggesting the Camino, but in telling me before he died that one of his greatest regrets was he loved the book, The Alchemist. And he said one of his greatest regrets is not crossing his desert that he felt his soul had been sent here to cross. And that was to truly love. He said, I faked it. I hid from it. He said, I love my boys. But women, he said, I took the shortcut every time. And I regret that I never risked really doing the tough kind of love. And he said, make sure you cross your desert, Molly. And I'm thinking, what is my desert? What's my desert? So after he died, I thought about that. I never got to tell him that I was going to walk the Camino to find my desert. And what mine was to finally surrender and make peace with my body. And as soon as I did that, it cooperated. So I wish I could have told him. But I didn't have to worry about that because he showed up. When we had spread his ashes here in Colorado, he has a song called Bristlecone Pine, and he wanted his ashes put under a bristlecone pine. And underneath the pine where we spread them, I found this beautiful sparkling rock. And I took it home with me. And I had no idea I was going to take it on the Camino. The Camino was about a year away. And the morning I left for the Camino, I took the rock off and I said, I'm going to leave this a Cruz de Ferro in honor of Michael, who challenged me to cross my desert. So I put it in my little zipper pocket that I put everything else in that I wanted to take to Cruz de Ferro. And people who don't know, it means the Iron Cross. And it's this point of the Camino where that millions of pilgrims over the centuries have left a stone or an item to lessen their burden in life, whatever they wanted to let go of, or maybe honor someone who had passed, or whatever you wanted, you leave something at Cruz de Ferro. So I had all my little rocks representing different things. And 2 days before I got to Cruz de Ferro, I was in a hostel with some other people. And everyone got talking about, oh, Cruz de Ferro is 2 days away. Do you have your rock? And everyone brought out their rocks to share what it meant to them. You know, I pulled out Michael's rock and shared how I got here. And it had a lot to do with Michael's challenge to face my desert, cross my desert, and live my legend. And so we all put him away and went to dinner. The next morning, my rock was missing, my Michael rock. I checked everything, you know, I had my passport and my money and my euros, and I checked to make sure I have all my rocks, and lo and behold, Michael's was gone. I tore apart my bed, I emptied my backpack, nothing. And at first I was really concerned, and then I thought, oh, wait a minute, I don't think I lost it. I think it's been disappeared. And so when I got out of the hostel and I was walking, when things got private, I was alone on the trail. I was leaving Astorga. And I said, all right, Michael, what'd you do with your rock? Because you took it, didn't you? And I heard as clear as a bell in my head, his voice going, yeah, I don't want to be up there. I liked where I was in Colorado, or I want to stay with you, but I don't want to be up on that mountain in Spain. He said, find something funny to leave for me, but that rock is precious. And I go, oh, okay, you're the one that got me here. All right, I'll do it. And I did find something to leave him. 2 days after Cruz de Ferro, I was in Villafranca, the only hotel room that I had had since Pamplona, was in heaven. And I had stuffed some, now my Cruz de Ferro zipper thing on my pack was empty, right? So I had put some bandages in there. I went to pull the bandages out and I hear this clunk on the floor. And I look and it's Michael's rock. I can't explain it. I just thought, okay, you win, you know? So now I have his rock. I'm telling you, that pocket was empty. So that was one of the magical things that happened that just made me laugh.
It's a great story. Yeah.
That's fun.
Your book is quite different, though, isn't it? It's not just sort of you open it to page one and then you keep reading and get to the end. You've got lots of different, like you said, the tips, and there's a lot of different aspects to it, which help breaks it up a bit.
Yeah, but the feedback that I'm really happy that I've gotten is people got the spirit of it and enjoyed it. I'm pretty irreverent, I have to admit. That's how I get through life, is twisted humor and irreverence. And people seem to appreciate that in the book. I have no problem being self-deprecating when I deserve it. And I'd like to think it's a fun book as well as insightful.
Are you going to be doing any more walks and writing about them? Or?
Well, let me tell you what happened. 3 years after I returned, right when we were coming out of the shutdown and my business was beginning slowly, I broke my foot. I've never broken a bone. I've had lots of injuries, but never a broken bone. It was a metatarsal and caught me by surprise, but the doctor said 6 to 8 weeks on crutches, you'll be fine. Well, I wasn't fine. I ended up with a blood clot in that leg, and the trauma of breaking it was a lot. And it caused a blood clot in my calf, which led to a syndrome in my foot that kept the bone from healing for a year. And my foot remains numb from the shin down. I've been to Mayo Clinic. We came up with the plan of how do I learn to walk on this? Once the bone healed, how do I learn to walk on a leg I can't feel? So it's been an interesting challenge. The theme of my life continues of partnering with my body instead of being angry at it. And I have been on my foot side this whole time. So I am doing well. I can walk like 3 miles, which it's funny, on the Camino that used to be 3 miles was your walk to breakfast. But now walking 3 miles is like this big feat, so to speak. So I don't have a plan to return to the Camino right now. I am enjoying the freedom of walking again, and I'm grateful for that. And I will take it, so they say, step by step.
It sounds like an amazing journey that you had, and I'm sure that lots of people would enjoy reading about it.
Yeah. I think, you know, we hear the cliche all the time, be in the moment. And it's one thing to read, be in the moment, to have a little sign, be in the moment, and talk about it. It's another to walk being in the moment. There was a book by Scott M. O'Neill called Be Where Your Feet Are. And it was the most profound support I had on the Camino, having read that, because it reminded me, Molly, don't be in your head, be in your feet, which is why the subtitle of my book is called Holy Dirt, and subtitle is Out of My Mind, Into My Body, Saved by Song. And that was the theme of my whole walk. Be where your feet are, Molly. Wake up. So that's one of the most grateful things I, quote, walked away with from the Camino, is be where you are. And without being cliche-ish, like, I have it down to my bones what it means to be where my feet are.
Well, that was definitely one of those interviews I could have chatted for hours. And Holy Dirt is definitely a great read. And no, I'm not on commission. I love the idea of the QR codes in each chapter so that you can listen to the music that Molly mentions in the book. Fortunately, the Beatles are in there. A few interesting choices too. You'll need to buy the book to find out. And it's available now for, currently, £14.66 on Amazon, although I appreciate that the cost can change. And it's also got very good reviews, and it's published by Brave Healer Productions. All right, so that's it for this week's podcast. No idea what we have lined up for next week. It will just have to be a surprise for everyone, including me. Not sure if or where I will be walking this weekend, but I will definitely let you know next week if it's anything worth mentioning. It's a public holiday here in the UK on Monday, so that usually means rain. Anyway, we will be back next week. I hope you enjoyed this week's WalkingPost.com podcast, and I hope that you have a great week, hopefully with a walk somewhere, or maybe just some new gear, because you can never have enough. So, until next time, happy trails! Walking Post from WalkingPost.com is an Air Coastal Media Limited production.